pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Tuesday morning. Text line, you want to be in touch with the show, 251-343-0106. Coming up on the program today, our state auditor, who just recently won a re-elect, Andrew Sorrell, will make time for us. Jerry Carl, running for Congress in the 1st Congressional District. We're almost a month away from that primary. We'll be with us in the 10 o'clock hour. And then, as we do every Tuesday, my friend from PTU Public Affairs, Will Hampson. Let's get into there with the Graham Plattner story. Guys, let's start with that. Because, I it's weird to me, the guy with the Nazi tattoo already has, like, some questionable antics in his life. And then, like, suddenly, this drops, this accusation drops, and now it's time for him to get out of the race. Like, the first, like, five red flags were, hey, that's just right-wing noise or people change. Fine. Now, in the, I guess they polled it. This is the Katie Britt theorem. They polled it. Susan Collins is, it's not even going to be close. Now it's time for him to get out of the race. Like I said, all these warning flags, all these warning signs, and now with these new allegations, they decided, the Democrats, that is, are calling on him to exit. It's a little too convenient. They need to own this. Elizabeth Warren, Ruben Gallego, Ro Khanna. All of these Democrats who stuck with him and now are moved on. I don't buy it. This is their Roy Moore situation. This is, and I'm going to tell you that the talking heads on cable news in this ordeal, they're quick to bring that up. But there's got to be more allegations. We're going to, and then probably after the election or after he drops out or loses or whatever happens here, we'll go away. So I'm not defending Graham Plattner. I think he is a terrible presence in the United States Senate. But come on. You had ample opportunity to get this guy out of this race and walk away from him. And the other thing is, I mean, this kind of tells you that the Chuck Schumer is not really that strong of a Senate minority leader. But that seems like that's everything right now, at least online. I think the sort of news media is very delicate with this. Well, we're keeping an eye on it. We'll spend some more time on that. Hey, Andrew Gillum. Who is Andrew Gillum? And I don't know if it's been talked about yet, but my former mayor, when I lived in Tallahassee, he was an awful, awful, awful mayor. He's one of these mayors who, like, DEI'd a hurricane response. We went, like, weeks without power, and they were servicing parts of the city that voted for him. Power went out. The city owned a utility in Tallahassee, and it was just a miserable experience, always getting these brownouts, blackouts, just corruption. There's always these, federal corruption investigation, rumors swirling around that town. Well, I guess he was on his way somewhere and got arrested in Daphne. Remember, he was the guy, he almost beat Ron DeSantis in 2018. The unlikely political path of Ron DeSantis from Congress beats a heavily favored Adam Putnam in a Republican primary and then ekes out a win against Andrew Gillum, who was not supposed to, by the way, he was running against like Gwynn Graham and a lot of kind of longtime Florida Democrats to win the Democrat nomination. And just comes close. We at the time, Florida dodged a bullet because if this guy had been elected to be the governor of Florida, Disney World would have gone dark. There would have been no power. It would have been pretty awful. Well, I guess he was arrested in Daphne Thursday by officers booked. This is according to TMZ. We're trying to get some more details on it. Booked in Baldwin County Jail for possession of dangerous drugs, drug paraphernalia, possession of marijuana, according to online records. Daphne PD has yet to release details on his latest brush with the law. And then there was some other scandalous behavior that occurred right after he lost. It was just kind of this crash landing almost for Andrew Gillum, who was riding pretty high. He was like the future of the Democratic Party. I guess he got pulled over. And in Daphne. Maybe he's on his way driving down I-10 or something. I don't know. So that happened. It's just kind of interesting. There's your Alabama connection, though. But I lived under this man's leadership, and it was not good. There's just all these allegations that somebody, and they think it was a Fed, maybe, who was, and there was some property and things like that and some favorable deals to cronies. But he ran for governor, and it sort of all fell apart for him after he lost. You know, sad story. Not really cheered for anybody to have a fall like this, but just notable, I guess, for this audience that it occurred in our neck of the woods. So, soccer. Belgium blowing out the U.S. 4-1. Not really. Can we care less about soccer now? It's great. We really like every European that with a Twitter account that goes to a Bucky's. We're making a headline out of it. It's just hard for me to embrace it. I watched some of it. I did not watch last night. We were watching baseball at our house. Probably should have watched the soccer. But will Americans continue to watch the World Cup as it continues? I guess we could cheer for England. I don't know who do you cheer for when the U.S. loses? Who's your team? If those of you who are soccer aficionados, I can't get into it. I tried at previous World Cups, but and then it became a story yesterday when Donald Trump apparently had gotten one of the players reinstated, the red card suspension pulled, and we keep here at the Fairhope Bureau One Television, most was the DirecTV like 4-channel news feed, and it's got like Fox, CNN, and MS Now, and then the other on the fourth screen in the corner there's BBC, and I mean it was wall to wall. It was big news in America news, but that's all they want to talk about on the BBC news. was that. 251-343-0106 if you want to be in touch with the program. We saw that, just heard on that newscast at the top of the hour about a ship getting it. Oil's creeping up $70 a barrel. It's up 2%. That's regression, I guess. Need that to whatever those fears are to be calmed. Another kind of interesting story here, and hopefully gas prices move in the right direction. So, you know, and any of you have gone shopping, and I notice that the price of beef, the price of a lot of things, gradually increasing because of inflation. Well, I guess Walmart is going to go the other direction. They're slashing some of their prices. And my friend John Carney at 18, I mean at Breitbart News thinks you could see negative inflation for a couple of months. This from the Wall Street Journal. Walmart is cutting prices on thousands of items. The largest U.S. grocer said Monday it is lowering the price of ground beef by 12%. The price of cherries is being halved. A 24-pack of Coca-Cola is falling by one-third to $9.97. And then it says cutting prices on a bunch of other products. And I got a True Social post. Walmart is stepping up in a big, bold way, and other retailers should follow the lead of these absolute patriots. And that's entirely possible because Walmart has so much market share that we could see other retailers follow suit. They would have to. Now, this is ground beef. I don't know what ground beef sales are and how that works. It's not as if they're going to be cutting the price of ribeyes and T-bone steaks or whatever. But this sounds promising as we head into the second half of the summer. But I think this is, you know, these are the kind of things we need to see for Republicans to do well in November. They need economic metrics to start moving. Consumer confidence is high. People are still spending. It's not as it feels like the economy's not heading to a bad place. But I think a lot of this is going to be contingent on what happens in the Middle East and the way they keep the Strait of Hormuz handled. That's going to impact input cost. But a lot of this container shipping traffic has got to get through that strait and out to market. Now, once it does, and some of that backup, and kind of looking at it now on Fox, they're talking about the tanker strike, that it was very close to the Iranian shore here, it looks like. Well, once that starts moving in a good direction, the economy picks up, then that's one less thing for Republicans to have to worry about. Plus, let's hope Graham Plattner can stay on the ballot in Maine. 251-343-0106. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
On a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried.
Get on me, want to know, Hank, why do you drink? Hank, why do you roll smoke? Why must you live out the songs that you wrote? Over and over, everybody made my prediction. So if I get stoned, I'm just
back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Tuesday morning. 251-343-0106. 0-6. Paul writes, I think Plattner's KSC was about Dibs trying to get a masculine dude who is also a leftist. Whoops. I don't know. Maybe there's a masculinity play there, but I do think that the think there's a revolt in the Democratic Party. They can manage a few House members who are DSA types, but they can't handle a senator. They're afraid of that. They know that somebody like that will come in and just blow the place up. It's a little surprising. Stephen King's out there saying that, I hope he doesn't drop out, but not very many others are. Why does Stephen King matter? Because he's from Maine. No, it's a Nazi tattoo, and the whole Lindsey Fifield revelations did not undo this guy. We're going to get another one here. Now, I think he deserves a due process. If he is out raping women, then obviously that is a disqualifier. But it's also like very plausible somebody would just come out and say this. And there's no repercussions. The whole Me Too movement, now they got to own it. So the first round of allegations weren't good enough for him to drop out, but these are. This is it's a little too opportunistic for my taste. When they start seeing some of the polling and Collins running away with it, oh, well, we got to do something here. Continuing on, Ben, wasn't he found down and drugged out in some seedy hotel room after he lost a gubernatorial race? Yes, Andrew Gillum in South Beach was found with a male prostitute, apparently. Maximus, I'm with you, Jeff. Who cares? This is about soccer, I assume. It's so hard. I want to get patriotic and I want to cheer USA and I'm not cheering against them, but as far as caring about a sport that I guess is part of the culture now more than it's ever been, but just it's not one of our mainline spectator sports. And I feel like it's a little forced. The marketing and I know some of the stadiums are selling out, but it's not like football or baseball or basketball. You know, people are watching. I mean, they even watch like WNBA or hockey or whatever. But soccer just never. Soccer's like the sport for guys who can't play sports in school, like me. Now, I know some of these soccer players go on and they're very athletic and they can run around. And eventually are good soccer players. I mean, but generally speaking, it's not something you really, there's just, it's not a mainstream American sport. It's a mainstream American sport in a lot of countries, just not here. Our top athletes don't play soccer. They go to play other sports, and they're more revenue-producing sports. I'm sure soccer's a very hard game to play, and you have to be athletic and fit, but to be honest, like, the real athletes in America go play baseball, football, basketball, or even hockey, and you'll feel it up north. You had a guest on several weeks ago that had a personal encounter with Plattner. His female friend worked with him in Washington, D.C. It was shocking when I heard the story he shared. Please recap and tell us who your guest was. I can tell you about a little bit about it, maybe later in the program. 251-343-0106. That's how you get in touch with the program. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Keep your head up.
keep your foot hard on the pedal. Some tell my mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got a run to make.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porras Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for hanging out with us on this Tuesday morning. Text line, you want to get engaged with the program, 251-343-0106. Still to come about an hour from now. Jerry Carl running for Congress here in the 1st Congressional District. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, Will Hampson from P2 Public Affairs, our Tuesday regular, will make time for us. So we'll get into Graham Plattner and what this all means for the some of these races nationally, as we turn our focus away from Alabama politics to a more national kind of focus here. But in the meantime, joining us now on short notice, and we're very appreciative, while on vacation, I might add, far, far away, our state auditor, Andrew Sorrell, joins us on the line. Andrew, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jeff. I've joined you from all over the U.S. on your radio show. I remember one time doing it from Key West, Florida, and now I'm in northern Michigan. But, hey, if Jeff asks you to come on the radio, you drop what you're doing and come on the radio. So
I wish here more, I am. I wish more people adopted that that orthodoxy, but it just isn't the case, especially now election season's over. Speaking of which, this is a pretty – successful for certain elements of the Republican Party here in Alabama, a Republican primary. Not everything went that way, but I think in general you have to be pleased with what you saw.
This is the best election cycle I can remember. If you want to gauge how well an election cycle went by the number of liberty-loving patriots that got elected in the Republican primary, then this is the best one. I've been paying attention since 2010, and I don't ever remember this many winning. We had conservatives win up and down the ballot. And look, I remember in 2022, to be quite frank, there was only a couple elections that went the way that I voted on them. So, you know, to have almost everybody that I voted for on the ballot this time actually win, that's very rare for me to experience. We've got some real conservatives headed to D.C. to represent us. In fact, we're going to have two senators from the same city, as I'm sure you've noted on your show, and one congressman likely will also be from that city. So some really interesting things happened. And I think what you saw was Montgomery's special interest losing power this election cycle. Many of their candidates just did not win, and it didn't matter how much money they pumped in. You saw that in legislative races where candidates were outspent, you know, $1 million to $200,000 for that matter. I was outspent $1.1 million to $180,000, and I was able to get 68%. In my primary for re-election as state auditor. So, you know, money has always been important in politics. It's certainly not everything. And I think what you saw this cycle was messaging was more important than money. Having the right conservative message and appealing to the grassroots in the state, that's what actually mattered this election cycle, not just running, you know, three TV ads every 30-minute news segment.
Well, and I think it's this, too. And the whole racket's getting exposed for what it is, and it's just an antiquated playbook. But, I mean, it's a business set up where, you know, certain people benefit from it, and they make their money, and they make their living off of it. But what they're doing, something's changed in this state. It was really obvious from the get-go, especially with the polling. The polls in general were terrible. But before, I mean, just a high number of undecideds saying they were likely voters, that the message wasn't connecting with these voters. They weren't making up their mind early. Despite some candidates getting in like a year and a half out, you know, it just the numbers never moved, that what they're doing just doesn't work anymore in this state.
Well, yeah, you couldn't be more right about that. And again, I think having the right message was more important. But let's look at the lieutenant governor race, for instance. Voters make their mind up in the last 4 weeks before a primary. That's the truth. That's what happens. So starting early can give you some advantages. It can help you raise more money. I can help you get grassroots connections around the state. You can get all of your signs up. All of those things you're doing early on, though, you got to realize that 95% of Republican primary voters are not paying attention. Now, who's the 5% that are? Well, those are the ones that listen to talk radio. Those are the ones that go to the Republican women meetings. Those people, they do make their mind up early, and they have some impact on the outcome of the election. But in the lieutenant governor race, you know, there was a Yellowhammer poll. I don't think Yellowhammer ran the poll, but they reported the poll, and it had John Wall down 29-12 in the lieutenant governor's race. That came out a week and a half before the primary. And on primary day, John was up 40-38. How could your poll possibly be that bad? Well, you begin to think it's intentional. I used to think, wow, these pollsters in Alabama are so bad. I don't believe they're bad anymore. I believe it's intentional. I believe they're trying to drive a narrative with their polling. Because if you get a poll that comes out that shows you up 29-12, what does that do? Well, it helps your fundraising. And some people just kind of want to follow the winner. They want to vote for the person they think is going to win. Right or wrong, that can be human nature. My polling was not that bad. Now, I know you know the guy that I worked with very closely on polling. I know he's a friend of yours. I know he comes on your show. Our polling for the runoff, for instance, I don't know that we were off more than 2.5 points in any race, adjusting for the fact that we knew Jared Hudson outperformed by 7 to 10 points in text message polling over the old IVR system. So once we adjusted for that, we were able to even predict the Barry Moore race within a couple points and predict that one correctly as well. But in many of our races, like for instance, the lieutenant governor's race, we had that as a 58-42 Wall victory. Well, on election night, he got 57%. It doesn't get much better than that in polling. So I think polling still works. You've had to change methods. You don't, the IVR system, interactive voice response, that just doesn't seem, you don't get the response rate anymore. You've got to go to text messaging. And that creates some challenges, but we've been able to figure those out and work through them. And if you're actually trying to get the right number, you can still do it. You can still get polls that are nearly pinpoint accurate. You know, we had Jim Ziegler at 51.5. He got 51.3 the next day. Again, it doesn't get much more accurate than 0.2%. So I believe these pollsters in Alabama, and I loved your article on 1819 News about it, exposing them for how bad they are. But I don't think they're bad. I think it's intentional.
Well, I think the methodology, they may know the methodology is flawed, but it's going to, when you use that methodology, it favors their candidates, and that's why they continue to use it. But the bigger picture here, I think, is, well, the polls are what they are, and that's a discussion, but the things they are doing in the campaigns, and you mentioned being up on TV, the way these campaigns are reaching voters, they're not making that connection like they used to, using these old sort of tricks of the trade. It's like a playbook that's maybe 10 years too old or something. And it's just the way we always done it in Alabama. But that doesn't work anymore. The world has totally changed, and these guys are a little slow to catch up to it.
I'm disappointed in the class of consultants we have in Alabama. I think they did a very, very poor job for the amount of money that they made. You know, consultants are making 15% on all the media buys. You run a mailer, you run TV ads, you run radio ads, you do digital. They're all making 15% cut. And this is donors' money that's being spent here. And if you're talking about $2.6 million in a race and 15% of that's coming off the top for consulting, not to include the $5,000 or $7,500 a month they're charging the candidates on top of that just for general consulting services, some of these consultants, whether they win or not, they're making $250,000 or more off of a race. You know, my opponent, again, he spent $1.1 million. Well, somebody made $200,000 consulting that race in an effort that only got 32%. And if you look at the candidates that were unsuccessful, they all had something in common. Nobody had any idea what they were running on. I'm not going to call out any names here, but there were candidates for high political office in Alabama statewide. And at the end, I was discussing this with a friend of mine, and she said, why did such candidate lose? And I said, tell me, what was their campaign platform? She said, I don't know. This is one of the most informed people in Alabama. She said, I don't know. And I said, that's why they lost. They don't know what they were running on either.
Yeah, I just, their messaging wasn't crisp. It wasn't compelling. I mean, you would have these candidates who'd get up and they'd talk about themselves, but it wasn't really a policy oriented discussion. And some of these races are hard, lieutenant governor being one of them, because it's the narrow scope of power. But you can be for something. You can be for something, and that's what kind of resonates with people. And there was kind of a lack of that, I thought, in a lot of the races.
You know, voters reward politicians taking principled stands and telling what they're going to accomplish. So you brought up lieutenant governor. Let's talk about that one for a second. So John Wall comes out and says, hey, in order to be competitive with our surrounding states, we need to eliminate the Alabama state income tax. We need to phase it out over about a 10-year period. And people went nuts. They were like, oh, my goodness, the lieutenant governor doesn't have that power. How could he even say such a crazy thing? You had like 25 legislators get on Facebook and whine about the lieutenant governor doesn't have the power to do that. And it was ironic because every single one of the people whining about it does have the power to draft and introduce that legislation. Not one of them said, this is a good idea. I'm going to actually go do it. Now, I'm going to make a prediction right now. Alabama state income tax will be eliminated. It will begin, I think, in the next quadrennium, the next 4 years, it will begin to be phased out. And it's because you have strong leadership. John Wall campaigned on that issue. The voter responded to that issue. And rather than whining about how the lieutenant governor doesn't have the power to do that, you know, when Donald Trump campaigned for president, did he have the power single-handedly to eliminate overtime tax? Did he have the power to single-handedly eliminate tax on tips? No. Did he campaign on those issues? Yes. Was he successful in getting tax on tips removed? Of course he was, because Congress followed his leadership. That's what I expect to happen with the state income tax as well.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, like, what if you're not going to run on these big ideas, even though you can't do it directly, but with even a magic wand, which we all understand that, what are you running on? Why, you know, why do you want to be a lieutenant governor? How are you going to use that office in a way that's positive or for change and talk about things? And, like, the lieutenant governor office is that way about everything, yet that didn't stop any of these candidates from talking about these big ideas. And I just thought that was odd and a little strange that would be something to gripe about.
Well, look what Will Ainsworth did with the lieutenant governor's office. He came in and he championed a few issues. In 2019, he championed the pro-life bill, the strongest in the nation pro-life bill, and even used some procedural tricks to help pass a cleaner version of that bill. Then his next big push was the grocery tax. Well, guess what? Every single legislator, all 140 of them, ended up co-sponsoring a bill to reduce the tax on groceries. Then he took on, we're going to widen I-65. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but at least I can tell you three big things that Will Ainsworth worked on as lieutenant governor. Two of them successfully, one of them still in progress. That's what voters want. And what candidates forget is that every single elected official, your number one role as an elected official is not to recruit jobs in industry. It's not to, you know, infrastructure projects. Like, all those things are necessary and good, and you want your elected officials to work on them. But what's the role of any elected official? To preserve individual liberty and freedom. That should be the answer, whether you're running for dog catcher or whether you're running for president. So me as state auditor, there's a lot of policies. Guess what? I don't have a vote in the legislature anymore. There's a lot of policies I can't directly do anything about as state auditor. But can I bring them up and lead the charge on them? Yes. And I did that. You saw with the Candace Brown situation. You had a breastfeeding mother who was not being allowed to get into a jury duty exemption. How in the world is she supposed to serve on the jury when she's having to breastfeed her baby every hour and a half? It's impossible. And a judge told her, don't come back here with your baby again. We're going to take your baby and give him to DHR. You have to serve on this jury. That's unconscionable. That has nothing to do with the state auditor's office. Yet I led the charge on that issue, did a statewide media tour. The Supreme Court ended up changing their rules, and I got Representative Susan DeBose and Senator April Weaver to introduce that legislation, and it passed and got signed into law. And that's just an example of the power you have as a statewide elected official to speak out on an issue and affect positive change for people. Do you think Candace Brown cares whether it was a state auditor that helped her or some legislator? No, she just wanted it done. People want elected officials who get things done.
Right. I just thought it was kind of like, it just seemed like desperate almost to criticize for being against the income tax. We know how it works. The lieutenant governor can't do it, but lieutenant governor can be four things in state policy. But that's just it too. Like, the messaging, maybe it not only was it not connecting, it was just kind of bland for some of these offices.
Well, if your message is I'm running for an office that has no power to do anything, but I'm going to preside over the Senate, that's a really weak message. That doesn't motivate anybody to get off the couch and go vote for you on election day. Like, take some principled stands. The smarter thing to do would have been to steal the issue and say, yeah, we are going to reduce the state income and I'm going to do it faster than you. That's the correct response. I remember when I was running in 2018, my opponent, who in the general was a Democrat, he comes out for the elimination of the grocery tax. He does a Facebook post about it. I was like, well, shoot, I'm for that, too. I want to get rid of the grocery tax. I'm all for reducing taxes. I came out for it even bigger than him. I just completely stole the issue from him. And I said, yeah, we're going to get rid of that grocery tax. And I put $1,000 in Facebook ads behind the message. And by the end of the campaign, everybody thought that I was the guy who was going to get rid of the grocery tax and not the opponent. And I remember it frustrating my opponent. That's a way better strategy. than just saying, oh, well, he already said something about that issue. I guess if he took that position, I'll take the opposite. Sometimes your opponent takes the right position.
Listen,
and you need to join them.
The Democrats, and it was, what, Anthony Daniels, the first go-around on the overtime tax. That when the Republican Party is weak on some of this, the lesson here, well, Democrats are going to seize on these opportunities, and in some cases, taking more conservative stance than some of our Republican leaders in the state house.
I'm embarrassed that a Democrat led the charge on getting rid of the overtime tax in Alabama. And I'm actually, this may be the only time I ever say this, I'm proud that Anthony Daniels got that bill done. And the Republicans undid it when it expired. They didn't renew it. And that's a real shame. But here you have a Democrat standing up saying the people who are working the hardest in Alabama are the ones who deserve the tax break. Amen to that. When was the last? Normally, Democrats want handouts for people who aren't working. Here we have one saying, no, the people in my district who are working 55 hours a week, they shouldn't have to pay any income tax on the last 15 hours of labor they do. Wow, what a great idea. And instead of making that permanent, which I believe we had the money to do,
yes,
you know, tighten your belt a little bit. What did we do? We just let it expire.
Let it expire, and then they come back with their version that's just way, 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 way weaker than what was initially on the books.
The version they passed will save the average overtime worker $50.
Yeah.
That's it.
It was they were checking a box, and they needed to be – we called them out, but, they still get the – they wanted that W, but they want to – I don't know. There's like this this prioritization problem in Montgomery where I'm all about fiscal responsibility and smart budgeting, but like that is the end all be all. It's not, you know, there's no spending cuts. There's not a DOGE or something like that, that there just seems to be a lot of bloat in our state government. And the name of the game is preserving that and just not getting into proration or whatever.
What you see Republicans bragging about in the legislature today is how big the budget is. A record-breaking budget. They actually put it in their press releases like it's something we should be proud of. I'm like, no, I'm ashamed we've grown our budget faster than the state of California has the last 7 years. Like, that's crazy to me that we did that. And Republicans are out there bragging about it rather than looking for ways to cut government. I cut my own budget last year 1%. Now, my opponent said I only did it because it was election year. Well, I got news for him. This year, I'm cutting it 2%. Already had the meeting with my staff, and I said, we got enough room in our budget. We're going to slice another 2% this year. 2 years in a row, we're going to cut our own budget.
Right.
Nobody in government cuts their own budget, but we're going to get it done.
Andrew, you're very kind to make time for us. Enjoy the rest of your vacation, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to be on.
Andrew Sorrell, our state auditor there. Let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Tuesday morning. 251-343-0106. Jerry Carl coming up in the next hour, and then 11 o'clock hour, my buddy Will Hampson from P2 Public Affairs will join us as well. Back to this. Texter asked, you had a guest several weeks ago that had a personal encounter with Plattner. His female friend worked with him in Washington, D.C. Was shocking when I heard the story he shared. Please recap and tell us all who your guest was. It was Todd Stacy, regular on this show. Back during the time when all this went down, Todd was working for Congresswoman Martha Roby. He was her comms director, working in Washington, D.C. And there was a place that people would go after work to drink or who worked on the Hill. Everybody had their own little spot, depending on what side of the hill you worked on. But the Tune In is very popular with Capitol Hill staffers. The Tune In, kind of divey place down on the end of Pennsylvania Avenue. It's not the touristy places like Hawk and Dove or whatever's there now. Cap Lounge. But it was a place a lot of people would go. I'm sure it's still there. And that's where they would go. And Lindsay Fifield was the person in this story. This is what a New York Times report about Graham Plattner. she is from Montgomery. He was from Montgomery. It just sort of, you know, there was like, there's always been this in DC circles, sort of a group of people from the same hometown or the same locality. And they'll meet. We had like an Auburn bar that we would go to, and there was like an Alabama club when I was there. And you just hang out and watch the game or whatever, and socialize. And this is where they would go. And Plattner was a bartender at the Tune In. And that's where they got to know him. And apparently the what had happened was Lindsey Fifield started dating Graham Plattner. And that's when all these allegations supposedly took place, to where that New York Times story. Small world, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? 251-343-0106. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.